Hello there. Today is Thursday, November 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump touts what he says are great achievements on his Asia trip. Sexual assault allegations continue to roil a Republican Senate candidate.
Not one time have I ever seen him act even remotely inappropriate against any woman, toward any woman.
Zimbabwe's leader of 37 years is said to be under house arrest. Also ahead, what People Magazine is named sexiest man alive. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that America's standing in the world has never been stronger after his just completed two-week trip to Asia. Trump stood in the White House and gave a recap of his five-nation tour, which he called historic and a tremendous success.
In Asia, our message was clear and well received. America is here to compete, to do business, and to defend our values and our security.
Also, the president noted progress in actions against North Korea's nuclear efforts.
The United States welcomed the decision of President Moon to remove the payload restrictions on missiles to combat the North Korean threat. And together, we reaffirmed our commitment to a campaign of maximum pressure.
VOA White House correspondent Pete Heinlein has more on the president's speech Wednesday.
During a 22-minute nationally televised speech from the diplomatic room in the White House, President Trump touted the successes he has achieved during this five-nation, 12-day trip to Asia. Speaking in an address that was carried live on the cable news networks, he emphasized especially the success he says he's had in getting together a strong consensus that North Korea needs to be reined in. He said, throughout the trip, we asked all nations to support our campaign of maximum pressure for North Korean denuclearization. And he said they are responding by cutting trade with North Korea, restricting financial ties to the regime, and expelling North Korean diplomats and workers. He said, over the last 2 weeks that he has made historic strides in reasserting American leadership. He also talked at length about how much has been done on the trade front, saying, we established a new framework for trade that will ensure reciprocity through enforcement actions. He said, they're pushing for reform of international organizations and new trade deals that benefit the United States and partners. He said, this is our vision for the future, a future which is still only a dream. So it was one of those upbeat speeches. We were expecting news. He, during his trip, said he would make some news when he came back. There wasn't much news in there, but it was mostly just a talk about how well the trip had gone.
All right. Well, Trump did make no mention of human rights during Wednesday's speech, except for North Korea. The topic scarcely emerged during his Asian visit, including in the Philippines, where President Rodrigo Duterte has been accused of encouraging extrajudicial police killings of suspected drug users and dealers. Meanwhile, President Trump dodged questions about the turmoil in the Alabama Senate race on Wednesday, declining to join National Republicans who've been calling for candidate Roy Moore to abandon the race amid allegations of sexual impropriety with teen girls. Trump was characteristically silent when faced with questions about the scandal. And far from surrendering, Moore's camp is challenging the credibility of one of the accusers. His campaign chair and personal attorney addressed reporters trying to undercut the story of one of the women, accusing Moore of sexually accosting her when she was in high school. That attorney, Philip Jeruigo, demanded that the woman release the school yearbook she contends Moore signed, questioning whether the signature was actually Moore's, and said it should be submitted for analysis.
So right now, Trent Garman, our attorney, has sent a letter or is sending a letter to Gloria Allred demanding that the yearbook be released. We'll send it to a neutral custodian who'll keep chain of custody. And our professional expert will examine it and will find out, is it genuine or is it a fraud?
Well, joining me now to talk more about the latest developments and the bigger picture here about what's been happening more and more with so many women coming forward from all walks of life in different situations is Bonnie Stabile, I should say, professor of public policy at George Mason University. What do you make of all this today?
In my view, it follows a longstanding narrative that women are just not believed, particularly about sexual assault or sexual harassment in general. And I think it's sort of a battle to have women's voices heard in the public sphere. You know, if we cast doubt on women's voices when they come forward with allegations of rape and sexual assault, then you have to believe that it sort of inhibits their ability to speak more broadly about other issues. And women are underrepresented in the halls of Congress, only 20%. That's a number that we see at every level of government, and it's even worse at the highest levels of business organizations. I think it's, in essence, a way of silencing women. And interestingly, what I think is happening now is a battle for, if you see what just happened in the Virginia election, you know, last week, a bunch of women came forward with the election of Trump, who's sort of an admitted sexual harasser, at least. Women were kind of like, well, yeah, no, that's not okay with us. It really inspired a pretty big surge. I mean, 10 women were elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, which is an unprecedented number all at one time, and many more. There's been a spike, a surge in women running for office. And I mean, voice matters, and the only voice that really matters is the one that gets the vote. And women are now sort of getting that, aren't represented, then they don't get to make the laws. And I mean, there was an article in The Guardian yesterday about Roy Moore arguing that the rape shield law shouldn't prevent information about underage accusers from being brought forward to discredit them. So here's somebody who's now being very prominently accused of inappropriate sexual activity with minors, who we know, according to The Guardian anyway, in law, you know, his voting record shows that he was in favor of suppressing the voice of victims. So it makes sense because he's empowered as a lawmaker to make laws that privilege himself and other men who have power who, you know, they hold the power. I think that's the whole story. There's usually not witnesses to these events. People have tended to believe historically the guy with the suit and the tie and the power. And now more and more women, you know, right at this moment, we're seeing women coming in full force to support each other's voices.
Well, you mentioned President Trump, and I think there were a lot of expectations when he gave a big speech about his trip to Asia that he would mention his stance, and he was even asked and declined to comment. Could it be that if he were to, you know, believe the women's accusations against Moore, then his critics could question why those women's accounts are to be believed, but not the 11 women who accused him during the 2016 presidential campaign?
Well, I mean, he, even though he declared that it was locker room talk, he pretty much admitted to it. And he kind of said what I say, just in a different way, which is, you know, they let you do it like, mm-hmm. I have power. Mm-hmm. I can do what I want. I can act with impunity, we would say, right? Because I have power. I mean, in essence, that's the translation of what he said. So I would be very surprised if he would say that he believed Roy Moore's accusers. Yeah, I think by analogy, people would say, because he's playing by the same book. Mm-hmm. Every woman who's ever said anything bad about me has been lying. Mm-hmm. And he's the president of the United States. If you wield that kind of power, there's a power differential there, right? And it might not end well for women who come forward. So there is strength in numbers. The more women that come forward, the more women.
Do you think the climate has become more or less tolerant since the election of President Trump?
I've been surprised at the extent to which people, how they've excused his behavior because of some policy position that might favor them. But that mm-hmm. actually follows what we teach and understand in public policy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. people trade favors and, you know, so if it's to one's own material advantage, you're like, well, okay, he's a sexual assaulter. Oh, boys will be boys,
well,
you know?
Why do you think that these women with the Roy Moore case are coming forward a month before his election when this happened 40 years ago? That would be his analogy, saying that it's a political witch hunt.
Well, that's why, it's interesting, isn't it, that they use the word witch hunt, because we know that witch hunts were always ended up with the woman dying. Right? Women got drowned for being witches. So it's interesting that men are appropriating this term of victimhood, which actually a gendered female term. There weren't any, or not too many, right? It was right? But witch is a women's word. And they're, now when it suits them to take on that victimhood mantle, they'll happily take it on. The reason is, anybody who's studied sort of sexual trauma, how does one act when one is you know, sexually harassed or assaulted. People don't come forward. They have shame, they have stigma, they have guilt. They feel like in some ways they might have brought it on themselves, especially when there's a power differential. So we know people, and that's why these statutes of limitations laws are so inappropriate at times, because people either don't remember or don't have voice for sometimes decades. So if you really understand the issue, I think there could be a lot of like health professionals who would attest to that. And then the other thing is the same thing Anita Hill did, right? Which was when she was worried, when you see that man that you think acted inappropriately ascending to the height of power, you might say, you know, now I really have a problem with it. Like, or enough is enough. We're right now at a propitious moment, right, where women are more and more coming forward. We have the Bill Cosby thing. There's been a lot of discussion very publicly. So in some ways that may have empowered or, I don't like to use that word, but, you know, it's overused, but to encourage women to come forward with their stories. It's not unthinkable or beyond understanding that people wait. A lot of victims of rape and incest and harassment really wait sometimes their whole lifetimes to come forward, and there are very important, understandable reasons for that. It is another facet of victim blaming, another way to harm a victim. In essence, it is legitimately politically motivated, because if you know something that speaks to the character of someone who's going to hold one of the highest offices in the land, and you feel a civic obligation to come forward and share that with people, that seems to me like a legitimate exercise of your citizenship.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Bonnie Stabile, professor of public policy at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. and Japan naval forces have been conducting military exercises. Catalan's fugitive leader will campaign from Brussels. More worries in Congress over cuts at the State Department. And an abducted Swiss aid worker has been freed in Sudan's Darfur. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, on a visit to Myanmar, also known as Burma, expressed concern over credible reports of widespread atrocities committed by security forces and so-called vigilantes in the Rakhine State.
The humanitarian scale of this crisis is staggering. Over 600,000 Rohingya, mostly women and children, have fled to Bangladesh, and an unknown number from multiple ethnic groups remain internally displaced with limited access to food, water, and shelter. In response to this extremely dire situation, I am announcing today that the United States will provide an additional $47 million in humanitarian assistance for refugees.
Well, he spoke alongside Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Tillerson called scenes in the troubled Rakhine State just horrific and urged Myanmar to fulfill the recommendations of a report led by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, which included creating a path to full citizenship for Rohingya Muslims. VOA's Ira Melman has more details on Tillerson's visit as he spoke with VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain.
The secretary met with Myanmar's army chief, and he also met with a state counselor and former opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And afterwards, Tillerson had a joint press conference with Aung San Suu Kyi. And he did say that he did not think that broad-based sanctions against the entire country would be helpful at this time, but that the U.S. would consider some individual sanctions against people found responsible for the violence. And he said that he is very concerned about the suffering of the Rohingya people.
What did he say about the phrase being used that's open to question, that being that this whole situation is a case of textbook ethnic cleansing?
Well, he said that basically we're not there yet, that that needs to be studied and considered if that is the case. But he said that the United States does call for an end to the violence, and also announced that the U.S. is giving an additional $47 million in humanitarian aid to try and help the refugees. And he also said something that was interesting. He called for the Myanmar government to to allow refugees to return, to create safe conditions for their return, including, he said, a pathway to citizenship, which has been a very sore subject because Myanmar has never considered the Rohingya citizens of the country.
Aung San Suu Kyi, the at least civilian leader of Myanmar, has been heavily criticized for her silence or avoidance of controversial issues when speaking about this. What did she have to say?
Well, she was asked about that very point, Ira, and she said that she has not been silent, but that she has been careful about what she said. She said we mustn't forget that there are many different communities in the Rakhine and that they're to live together in peace. We can't set them against each other. She said she's making very careful statements and she doesn't want to drive people farther apart.
Did she give any kind of indication of how she feels about the criticism coming her way and to her country?
Well, she did say that, you know, she rejected the criticism and said that, you know, maybe what she said was not interesting enough or inflammatory enough. She did seem to be a bit sensitive to the criticism, but she said again that it's a very complex problem and a multifaceted problem, and she actually thanked Secretary Tillerson for being open-minded, saying open-mindedness is hard to come by these days.
Tillerson also met with some of the military leadership, correct?
Yes, that's right. He met with the Army chief, and you know, we didn't get an exact readout of what happened there, but he certainly conveyed to them U.S. concerns.
All right. Well, some analysts believe that Aung San Suu Kyi's reputation as a Nobel Peace Laureate and pro-democracy icon has been tarnished by all the criticism over perceived slow response to the crisis. Because she shares power with the military, though, criticism of Myanmar's state counselor, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been muted during the country's fragile transition. Zimbabwe's longtime president told his South African counterpart he is confined to his home, leaving Robert Mugabe's fate uncertain after what increasingly appears to be a military-backed effort to oust him after 37 years in power. Zimbabwe's military was in control of the capital, Harare, but went to great lengths to emphasize it's not staged a military takeover by starting a process to restore Zimbabwe's democracy. Here's the military's Major General S.B. Moyo.
To both our people and the world beyond our borders, we wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government. What the Zimbabwe Defense Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social, and economic situation in our country, which, if not addressed, may result in a violent conflict.
Still, the military appeared to have brought an end to Mugabe's rule in what the army supporters praised as a bloodless correction. South Africa and other neighboring countries were sending in leaders to negotiate with Mugabe and the generals to encourage the transition. But Moyo said the current feeling of unrest is temporary.
We are only targeting criminals around him who are committing crimes that are causing social and economic suffering in the country in order to bring them to justice. As soon as we have accomplished our mission, we expect that the situation will return to normalcy.
In Washington, the U.S. State Department said the Trump administration was concerned by recent actions undertaken by Zimbabwe's military forces and it called on the country's leaders to exercise restraint. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Lori, big breaking news. People magazine have named their sexiest man of the year.
Okay.
It's a silly topic, but in a day of a lot of heavy news, you know,
sometimes it's
fun to talk about silly things on social
media.
And sometimes those silly things end up trending because in the midst of all that heavy news, people want to talk about something light.
So who is it?
It is country music star Blake Shelton, and that is what has people talking.
Sexiest man in the world?
Sexiest man alive, Blake Shelton. I always think it's funny. What happens to the previous year's sexiest man alive?
I know.
Alive?
They're still alive, or...
so what are they? I don't know what happens to them. But a lot of talk about Blake Shelton because, well, people say he is attractive. They question whether he is the sexiest man alive. So this has become a point of contention on social media. A lot of people debating and talking about
that. Maybe they think he's sexier now that he's dating Gwen Stefani.
That's true. He is dating Gwen Stefani. They are on The Voice together. They were. That's how they met. So maybe a bit of publicity there in this naming. I'm not sure, but that's how Hollywood tends to work. But on a serious note, people are actually comparing this to Colin Kaepernick being named the Citizen of the Year by GQ magazine for his protests in the National Football League. People saying that Colin Kaepernick should have been named Sexiest Man Alive, or at least should have been honored for his contributions, as opposed to Blake Shelton, who is a singer and performer. But lots of suggestions as to other people that could have taken the title instead of Blake Shelton. This sometimes happens where people will protest, is particularly on social media, because that is the vehicle where the people's voice can be heard, and this is what they're talking about.
Wow. Okay. Well, what else is going on?
Hard to follow that up. But,
I know.
Luis Linton, who you might remember is the wife of Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
Yes.
She got in trouble on social media several months ago because she posted a photo where
about her high-end fashion.
She had tagged all these high-end fashion brands and told this woman that she was out of touch and didn't contribute enough to the country as she was. She got a lot of backlash for that on social media. Well, she's getting a lot of backlash again.
Uh-oh,
because
what'd she do now?
And her husband, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, visited the U.S. Mint today where... for the first time they have currency with Steve Mnuchin's signature on it. The Treasury Secretary, when they issue currency, new Treasury Secretaries have their signature on the currency along with the Treasurer of the United States. It's just a thing that's on every bill. So they started printing bills with Mnuchin's signature on it. And so he and his wife went to go review these bills and hold up a sheet of dollar bills, because they come in a sheet before they cut them, with his signature on it. Now, Louise Linton's getting a lot of attention on social media because she showed up in an outfit with long black gloves and a black leather skirt. And, of course, people are very fashion conscious on social media, saying that she looked like a villainess and saying all kinds of things. She had a look on her face where people were saying she did not look... like a happy person. She looks kind of brooding, and with the all-black outfit that only reinforced that. You know, it may be one of those things where she's getting undue negative attention just because of the previous transgression she has had on social media and what she's done. But right now, everyone is talking about her, saying not some nice things about it. Now, she's getting some defenders saying that it's unfair, you shouldn't focus on people's looks, and that she did apologize for the social media snafu several months ago. But so far, it does not look like that has endeared her to the social media world writ large.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. We always appreciate it. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, in June of 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage is legal nationwide. And now Australians have voted decisively in favor of legalizing same-sex marriage in a landmark postal survey. Almost 62% of those who took part in the non-binding poll favor allowing same-sex couples to wed. That's according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics 8-week ballot. Turnout was about 80%. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
61.6%.
This is a historic day for Australia. The emphatic result was greeted with jubilation around the country.
Nearly 8 million people, about 62% of those who voted in the postal survey, are demanding that same-sex couples be allowed to marry. The result isn't legally binding, but Australia's centre-right Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is promising a new same-sex marriage bill within weeks.
They voted overwhelmingly for fairness, for commitment, for love. And now it's our job as the Australian Parliament, all of us here, to get on with it and get this done before Christmas.
The No campaign said gay marriage would threaten religious freedoms and expose children to radical views on homosexuality in the classroom. Opponents of gay marriage say they'll respect the result of the postal survey. Lyle Sheldon from the Anti-Reform Coalition for Marriage has congratulated his rivals for their decisive victory.
This is a democracy and they have been relentless in this, and they have seen the fruit of their relentlessness and their involvement in the political process. That's been rewarded today by this result.
The 8-week postal survey has at times been divisive and toxic, with accusations of bigotry and bullying on both sides of the argument. But for many Yes campaigners, the celebrations are continuing. At an event in Sydney, Robbie, an activist, said it had been an emotional day.
Thank you so much to the people of Australia. One little step of progress. I am so grateful. I am so happy.
The landmark vote comes 20 years after Tasmania became the last remaining Australian state to decriminalise male homosexuality. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. Find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The West Bank is littered with landmines and unexploded ordnance due to decades of conflict beginning as far back as 1948. A survey conducted in 2012 identified 90 minefields. Of these, 13 were laid by the Jordanian military between 1948 and 1967. The remaining 77 minefields were laid by the Israeli military following the 1967 war. And landmines are not the only problem. Over half a century of armed conflict has left swaths of land contaminated with unexploded ordnance. After so many years, much of this war material lies buried beneath the soil, deep enough that it cannot be found with metal detectors. It is nonetheless highly dangerous to anyone digging in the soil, be it a farmer plowing a field or digging a new wall, or children to play. Indeed, children are the most frequent victims of landmines and unexploded ordnance. Too often, they do not recognize the danger of these objects and may pick up or even play with explosives. Clearing these hazards has been a difficult task, and not just due to the nature of such indiscriminate killers. Some of the contaminated areas are under Palestinian control, others are under Israeli control, while a number of zones are under Palestinian Authority civil control and joint Israeli-Palestinian Authority security control. Getting permission to demine was a long and arduous process. Following years of negotiations, the first humanitarian mine action program in the West Bank finally began in April 2014. The only mine clearance operated in the West Bank is the Halo Trust, a non-political, non-religious British charity, as well as a U.S. non-profit organization that specializes in the removal of explosive remnants of war. The group has already disposed of thousands of landmines and unexploded ordnance in the West Bank and hopes to clear by 2018 at least 9 minefields that lie dangerously close to Palestinian communities. Over the past 5 years, the United States has provided over $4.1 million for humanitarian mine action activities in the West Bank, led by the U.S. Department of State and in partnership with the governments of the Netherlands and the United Kingdom. The United States is proud to support the Halo Trust's humanitarian mine action program in the West Bank.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.